All right. Thank you, Henry. I appreciate the opportunity to be here to talk about hydrologic connectivity. It's something that I have been thinking about quite a while. This is the scale that I generally think about hydrologic connectivity, which may be a little bit different than perhaps the goal of the session, but I think the goals, say, at the soil process scale are very important to the issues that we talk about as watershed hydrologists when we're thinking about this, perhaps this particular scale. This is a photo of Dry Creek, which is outside of Boise, Idaho, a semi-arid watershed where we do quite a bit of research on topics. Generally, the questions we're thinking about are down in these bottom boxes here. For example, runoff generation. Again, at the watershed scales, how does precipitation ultimately end up in streams from, say, small catchments on up to large river basins, and perhaps regional groundwater recharge in this mountain block? What, say, ratio of the annual precipitation ends up as groundwater recharge versus stream flow? And a lot of these questions we're starting to think about with respect to perturbations, primarily climate change in the western United States. It's common knowledge that the snowpack is changing, and the response of the hydrologic response of those perturbations are really kind of moderated by the interactions between landscape properties, the prevailing climate, what happens versus snow versus rain. And a few years ago, we realized, or perhaps recognized, read the right papers, that, you know, if we want to know about anything, the responses at large scales of these perturbations on these bigger questions, everything goes through the soil moisture. Soil moisture is kind of the, I think I saw a talk yesterday that identified it as the gatekeeper. We kind of look at it as the first pass filter that any of these effects pass through soil moisture to get down to these boxes down here. And so even if our interests, the questions that my colleagues and I work on are up here at the larger scale, we're stuck, forced at the smaller scale, thinking about soil processes. When I was kind of setting the stage for this talk, I did actually look at the session description, Henry. This is out of the session description, the influence of connected pathways on flow and transport in soils on scales from root holes to fractures to buried channels. And I thought, wow, that's a little bit different scale of connectivity to think about, but these are generally, so I stole a lot of photos from the web, so if these are your photos, thanks. generally the scales perhaps this session is about, if you look into the literature, you'll see hydrologic connectivity defined by various subdisciplines in hydrology very different ways. This is kind of maybe the scale that I'm a little bit more comfortable thinking about, and a paper by Stiglitz in 2003 defined hydrologic connectivity as the condition by which disparate regions on the hill slope are linked via subsurface flow. So here we're taking a step up in scale where the function of connectivity in this case is primarily to take these vertical inputs of precipitation, and really one of the tasks of a watershed is to take those vertical inputs and translate them to lateral flows, essentially to the stream. And if you could, if a watershed could impose a will, that's what it wants to do. And so in our definition at the watershed scale, this is what we're thinking about, is how our vertical inputs transferred laterally to the stream. And then there's even a next scale up. This is from Pringle, 2003. This is an extraction from her paper, a little hard to see. But another group of hydrologists are thinking about connectivity at the large river basin scale, and thinking about, say, how our headwater streams and alterations in in-stream diversions affecting hydrologic connectivity, primarily, and I like this definition, the water-mediated transport of matter, energy, and organisms within or between elements of the hydrologic cycle. So this is connecting the physical connectivity that perhaps, at least I'm more used to thinking about, and maybe most people in the room, to taking it to an ecological context at larger and larger scales. And so, in all of these examples, when we think about it, that this lateral catchment scale connectivity really is rooted in the soil processes connectivity that many of us in the room work on. And so in this talk, that's really what I want to do, is thinking that I just want to point out some examples from some of our work, but also work from the literature on hill slope and catchment scale connectivity mechanisms, and that'll probably take most of the time. And then kind of zoom in more to the role of these soil processes on that larger scale catchment connectivity. And if I have time, which apparently I do because the second speaker is gone, and think about directions for future work bridging the soil physics and catchment hydrology. And admittedly, this is where I kind of haven't got to, so since we have time after this, and if we're looking for discussion sections, I might suggest that this is where we go, is to think about how do we take these smaller scale soil physical properties and connectivity and either describe how it's related to catchment hydrology, and then perhaps think about how do we incorporate those processes into modeling strategies. All right, so I just want to go through some examples of catchment scale connectivity. The first one comes from Brian McGlynn's group at Montana State University out of a paper published by Jenkso in 2009. And Brian's group was working up in the Tenderfoot Creek Experimental Forest in Montana. And their question is thinking about how hill slope, riparian, and channel connectivity in upland catchments affect hydrologic response. And the gist of the paper is that, well, it's highly spatially and temporally heterogeneous. And this is a picture of the kind of the context that they're working in. These forests and hill slopes that rise up into the high alpine zones, and then between those hill slopes and their streams are these very well-developed riparian zones. And traditionally, a lot of watershed hydrology is thinking about hill slope stream connectivity, but you get outside and you walk around, it's like, well, it's got to get through this riparian zone. And after the group kind of recognizes some unusual hydrologic behavior, realize, well, you got to start thinking about how does the riparian zone moderate this hill slope to stream connectivity. And what Brian's group did was essentially, I think, installed 24 well transects and various tributaries and non-tributaries, just hill slope to stream sections, to monitor water type table dynamics and looking at the transient nature of the water table as the hydraulic connectivity mechanism, which might be a little bit different than perhaps the physical connectivity of root holes and fractures. So here we're looking at the transients of the water table. And what they showed, this is just some examples of their study sections. These are three different, say, scales that they're working on. Generally looking for topographic convergence zones, 9,000 meters squared up to 45,000 meters squared. To illustrate, they put wells in these transects, looked at the relationship between riparian dynamics and stream dynamics, and identified periods of the year throughout the watershed when connectivity is turned on. In other words, whenever mass and energy can be transferred from the hill slopes to the streams. And they made an interesting map to show, first of all, this little plot here, that they noted that as the upslope accumulated drainage area increased, the percentage of the time of year that connectivity occurs increases. And you can look at their maps, if you tilt it on the side, these bars here are percent, this is the scale of percent of the year that the upslope contributing area from what each one of these points on the stream network is connected. And we tip it up on its little side a little bit more, and you can see that it's quite variable along a stream network. It doesn't necessarily just increase downstream. It really depends on what this depends on is the topographic convergence and topographic connections between the upslope area and that stream. The red and the blue are different stream side dynamics. We're able to show that and really do a good job of mapping out that temporal connectivity of the upslope contributing area. And just a synthesis of some of the results, if we look at a threshold of 0.3 millimeters of runoff, this in their particular watershed is a significant runoff threshold. We show that these relatively high flows are occurring really when only 40% of the network is connected. Again, that's what these bars are, is the proportion of the watershed that's connected. And that only happens, and this is even in a wet environment, that only happens about 5% of the year or 18 days. Alternately, you can look at the other side of it, the less than 3 millimeters of runoff occurs about 40% of the network's connected. And that generally is happening 95% of the year. That base flow, when, this is in between storms, summer low flows, they identified that only 4% of the watershed, hill slope to stream, is actually connected, and we're just draining riparian zones, and that's happening most of the time. So even in these kind of higher, wetter environments where at least I kind of visualize connectivity all the time, the hill slopes are generally independent hydrologic systems from the streams. And so getting back to, say, maybe a discussion topic for later is like, well, we need to, in a modeling context, start to think about, well, how does this transient connectivity establish? Because we're going to see very different threshold behaviors between the times when hill slopes are disconnected versus connected. A second example of here we're scaling down a little bit from whole watersheds to hill slopes. This comes from Jeff McDonald's group, specifically Ilya Trump Van Meerveld, from the Panola Experimental Forest in Georgia, where they identified really the importance of bedrock topography on connectivity. If this is a topographic map of the surface of a plot, traditionally we may model the hydrology of a hill slope or small watershed by looking at the topography of the surface. We develop topographic indices to develop, say, downstream hydrologic connectivity indices. But what Jeff's group did is they mapped the underlying bedrock topography and showed that, well, if you, and then they have a trench at the base of their hill slope, and showed that actually you can't predict the outflows of the trench based on the surface topography. And it puzzled the group for years, saying, well, why don't these topographic indices work? Well, they do if you pick the right topography. And what's happening is that at the bedrock, the soil bedrock interface is where the flow paths are lining up, getting infiltration, vertical infiltration, which in this environment is generally always connected. The soil is wet, we get vertical infiltration down, and it developed this fill and spill hypothesis at the bedrock surface. Now, granted, we don't often have bedrock topography information, but we might use this study to start to think about, well, how can we start to incorporate bedrock into the models, because their trench outflows, which ultimately become stream flow, are much better predicted by connecting essentially the ridges and hollows in the bedrock surface. This is a picture of their field site where they installed dozens of piezometers at the soil bedrock interface. Oh, there's a PowerPoint version issue. And what they did is in the black box, which was white, is a time series of different storm events of different magnitudes. And with the numbers that you can't see up there, can you see those? Are there numbers on there? Well, there are numbers there. And what the numbers are storms, individual rainstorms of different intensities in time going increasing in intensity. And the blue is a map of their connected areas at the bedrock interface. And on this plot to the right is the response of each one of these storms, total precipitation to stream runoff. And what's happening here is more of the bedrock interface is wetting up and wetting up. It's not till we get to about 65 millimeter storm that we have a connected pathway at the soil bedrock interface. And that's when, in this particular study, we have a threshold and a response. Storms of smaller intensity do nothing for runoff. When the bedrock, in this particular watershed, this is the important connectivity pathway, then storms greater than that yield a hydrologic response. The next example comes from, this is from Dry Creek, and here we're moving into a drier environment. The Boise area is in a semi-arid environment. And we've done over about 10 years of investigations now looking at the hydrologic response, again, at fairly larger scales. And this plot of soil moisture really characterizes what's going on in the watershed, where the summertime, very dry, the soil moistures, this is one particular depth in one particular pit, but it does, I think, characterize what's going on. Very low soil moisture contents, got a relatively stable dry period, after which in the fall, when the plants turn off and the rains come back on, we jump up to a wet, stable state. And, during this dry period, the soil moisture, this is copied from Roger Gratian's 1997 paper, during this dry period, soil moisture tends to be spatially unorganized. We may have vertical discontinuities in the wetting fronts, and in this case, this is a map of connectivity and potential lateral flow. Essentially no lateral flow, hence no catchment connectivity at this scale. And when we jump up to this wet, stable state, then we can start to get spatially organized soil moisture patterns which facilitate lateral flow to the streams and hill slope to stream connectivity. So we've been chasing that topic down for a number of years in Southwest Idaho, primarily in two experimental watersheds, and I want to talk more about some specific work we're doing in these watersheds now. This is the Snake River Plain. Boise's on the north side of the Snake River Plain, and Dry Creek, which I just talked a little bit about, is up north of Boise. Reynolds Creek, which many of you in the room may be familiar with, is south of Boise down in the Owyhee Mountains. We're starting to do some more intercomparison studies between these catchments to think about these connectivity issues. And this is a tree line catchment, we call it, in Dry Creek, because it's an upside down tree line. It's where, down in the low elevation, we're very arid and dry, and we get up to the trees in this case. I think this is the first tree in the watershed. And we've instrumented the hill slopes with numerous logging soil moisture pits and runoff plots. In several of the pits, we have several depths of co-located moisture content and tension. We've done a number of experiments looking at tracer movement through the hill slopes to get at connectivity, piezometers and wells in the ephemeral streams. And this is just a simple summary of kind of the hydrologic year in this site where we're thinking about this connectivity. The top plot is our water inputs. So depth of total precipitation. Water input is the difference between precipitation and the water that actually enters the soil. So in the fall, those two are the same, but then our precipitation turns to snow, so we get storage on the ground surface, snow melt occurs, and the two come together, model evapotranspiration. The action is happening down in the soil profile. So this is the plot that I showed a minute or two ago, where we get this jump from a wet to a dry to a wet state. But an important thing in this site, in many snow-dominated sites, is that this stable, dry to wet conversion doesn't happen throughout the entire throughout the entire soil profile at the same time, primarily because in this particular case, the advent of snow, although precipitation continues, restricts the water input. So for much of the year, we get this vertical disconnectivity, inverted wetness profile, wet to dry. And so in this time period, which is a substantial amount of the year, if we believe that groundwater recharge and lateral flow can only occur when the soil profile is fully wetted, it just can't happen because of this inverted soil profile. Then the springtime comes, eventually moisture content of the soil bedrock interface wets up, and at that time, then we can relate it to our fully wet state, and lateral connectivity can occur. And this bottom plot here is a plot of stream flow. It's clearly an ephemeral stream. Stream flow turns on about now when we jump to this wet state. And what I want to put, and this is the snow melt period. You can track our snow melt to flow at the bedrock interface to the peak in stream flow. But what I want to point out is this blue line on the right axis. This is total dissolved solids in the stream. And during this low flow time of this ephemeral stream, stream water is very dilute. This is a snow melt event, which adds even more dilute water. This is another glitch here. If snow melt total dissolved solids were plotted, it would plot somewhere down here. And in this particular response, what's happening is we add very dilute snow melt water down here, and the stream concentration jumps up significantly. we get another pulse of essentially deionized snowmelt water, and the stream water jumps up in connections earlier. So we're starting to think about, well, why is that? And there's a lot of literature on coupled stream chemistry and hydrology. But in this particular case, we started thinking about hill slope stream connectivity back on this particular issue here, this inverted soil profile. And this is a simple numerical model using Hydrus 2D and completely unrealistic boundary conditions. But just to illustrate a point that when we get this, what's happening is this hill slope centered increases in soil thickness, which is very common in the site. And if we assume that rainfall and water input lays down a vertically homogeneous wetting front, which probably the rest of the talks in the session are going to say that doesn't happen, but we have some soil profiles in which this does, we end up with these dry soil pockets at the bedrock soil interface. And this particular plot that's happening on the left is the right is the hydraulic head at the toe of the slope in the stream. And what happens is that when this dry pocket closes up, we get a jump in the hydraulic head because basically this hill slope becomes fully connected to the stream. But right there it's not, and right here it is. And what this does, and we have some piezometric observations, is that changes the stream from a losing stream all winter long. Losing stream all winter long in this period, and then the stream, when that connects, the stream turns into a gaining stream, and we're not getting actually mass transfer from the entire hill slope to the stream, because it actually only happens for a period of a few days, not enough time for all the hill slope water to go downstream. But we're back through the animation, we are essentially allowing pressure translation from the hill slope that's messing around with the near stream environment. So we have a saturated wedge in the stream bottom that may be growing during the course of the winter, and this upslope connectivity essentially adds that head to the wedge, and the water that's been accumulating in the saturated wedge with accumulating solutes just goes right back into the stream. We've done water balance on the stream where we can account for the annual stream flow really from just the water in this saturated wedge zone, and it just kind of sloshes back and forth. The hill slope connectivity is essentially a hydraulic ram that turns that on, that connectivity on and off. In the same site, we also see that the stream flow cessation, the end of the ephemeral stream flow, is related to what's going on in the hill slope. So I'm not going to imply a causation, but it's an interesting correlation at the moment, that if we look at the hydraulic head through time in our unsaturated soil, so elevation and then in tension, for most of the year, if this is a time series of the head at this point and at this point, we get downward flow, high head to low head. Then in the spring, as the near surface dries out and sends the near surface soils to high tensions, we get a reversal in the hydraulic gradient. And this plot of stream flow, we noticed every year that the stream flow just shuts off, at least in the data. I thought, well, that's got to be a data glitch. But it turns out that turning off of the stream flow happens almost simultaneously every year with the time that at our deepest spot in the soil profile, the hydraulic gradient reverses. So what's happening there is that we're essentially relieving that burden of hydraulic head from the stream. The hill slope is becoming disconnected, and at that point, the stream turns off. The water's still there, but it's just kind of draining into that saturated wedge. So in that same site, so we're recognizing the importance of soil moisture distributions, whether it's actually a mass transfer of water or just a mechanism to facilitate pressure translation to the watershed. We have to understand the spatial distribution of soil moisture. This plot is just showing a correlation coefficient through time of the important controls on soil moisture distribution. And I'll just point out that soil texture plays a key role in the essentially the retention of soil moisture through the season. So now we're starting to think about, well, what are the controls on soil moisture and ultimately connectivity at larger watershed scales? And what we're coming to learn is that when these dry-ish times and places, that the spatial distribution, soil depth, and soil hydraulic properties are really setting the stage for seasonal hydraulic connectivity. This is just a map showing that we're putting a big effort now into modeling soil depth distribution. We've added soil moisture stations throughout the entire watershed. This particular study, we installed 8 stations and 4 north-south opposing pairs to really investigate the effects of aspect on soil moisture distribution and its effect on hydraulic connectivity. This comes from a student, Tony Smith. That's not Tony, that's another guy, I don't know, he got in there. So we're looking at soil moisture, and this is just some of the data from those sites. Each of these plots is an elevation pair from high elevation down to low elevation. And this is just volumetric water content through time. We can see that, as expected, the north-facing slopes tend to be a little bit wetter, but then those differences are exaggerated as we go down in elevation. If we convert those soil moisture contents to storage, which we're starting to think, well, the storage content is really what is this switch, this connectivity switch in these dry environments, we see that the differences at the high elevations on the north and south facing aspects collapse. They're essentially the same. Storage is, you know, a function of the depth of the soil and the porosity and the retention capabilities. And as we go down to the lower elevations from what is a forested environment to essentially a desert sagebrush and grasses, we get very large differences in the water being stored on these hill slopes. Now, this is a complicated interaction between soil properties and soil radiation and evapotranspiration effects, but we think we do see an impact of the soil properties. These are some data from those sites. We can actually see very distinct differences in the soil texture on the north-facing aspects versus the south-facing aspects. Essentially, it's all sandy, but the north-facing aspects here tend to have a higher component of fines. There's also a significant difference in soil depths. The north-facing depths tend to be a little bit deeper than the south-facing aspects. This is some work from Ivan Giroy and Molly Gribb. Ivan gave a talk on this yesterday, where we looked at this and said, well, let's take a little bit closer look on the role on aspect. And Ivan did a transect looking at the soil hydraulic properties on a north-facing aspect and an opposing south-facing aspect. And you can see there are very clear vegetation differences, which on the first call means, yeah, there's got to be some clear hydrologic differences as well. And Ivan did some multi-step outflow tests to get the retention curves on all these different cores in Molly's lab at Boise State. And this is just a conglomeration of all the retention curves from these aspects. And you can see visually that there's a very clear difference between the water retention curves on the north-facing aspects and the south-facing aspects, which in these dry environments, you know, our wet period is quite short, and it's the water retention capacities of the watershed that essentially dictate the survival of vegetation through the summer and the response and the ability for those hill slopes and soils to connect to streams. So we're starting to pay a lot more attention to the role of aspect. And on that topic, if we kind of take a broader, longer time scale, we've also seen that, you know, thinking about the physical properties, that the slope, this is looking up one of our valleys, that, and you can tell right away looking at this NAEP image that our north-facing aspects are shorter and steeper than our south-facing aspects. This is a plot of aspect versus slope to show that south-facing aspects shallow, north-facing aspects steep, and is a map of aspect throughout the watershed. And so there's some, basically, you know, we tend to look at these modern processes and connectivity, but data like these suggest that this connectivity is really rooted in kind of the co-evolution of landscape form and hydrologic processes. You know, we haven't fully sorted out the chicken and the egg questions of hydrologic response to landscape form, or, you know, landscape forms control and hydrologic response. We're working that out, but thinking about the textural differences on aspects, the basin asymmetry, the differences in water retention capacity, which all kind of integrate to cause differences in moisture storage on the hill slopes. And it's that moisture storage from our previous examples that are facilitating this hydraulic connectivity between the streams. So now we're starting to take these into a modeling framework. And rather than, we've done a full suite of physically based models versus lump parameter models. And this is some work from Mark Seifried, mostly in Reynolds Creek, where we're thinking, you know, our observations are that, boy, soil depth and water holding capacity rule the day in these semi-arid dry environments. Can we simulate the hydrograph of these basins simply by looking at the storage capacity of the soils? And what Mark showed is he developed just a, I guess we'll call it a bucket model, just identified salient soil hydraulic properties, the plant extraction limit, a field capacity limit, did a detailed job accounting for surface water inputs and the Penman-Monteith equation for evapotranspiration, ice snowbell, which is a physically based snowmelt model, and then the storage capacity model, combining those to simulate through flow and identified that connectivity occurs essentially when any particular point in the watershed is contributing through flow. In this case, through flow is vertical drainage rather than typical lateral drainage. And this is just to show that at a point, the simulations work well. At the distributed watershed, we take the distributed soil water input primarily from the snowmelt model, and then do the storage capacity model at every grid cell in the watershed to simulate through flow. We have a connectivity index that maps out when through flow is occurring throughout the watershed, and we see that simply by accounting for stream flow soil moisture connectivity, this is a map of the surface water input and then observed and simulated stream flow, you can get the hydrograph pretty darn good without any consideration for the lateral flow mechanisms, just accounting for essentially the vertical soil connectivity distributed throughout the watershed. And so now we're kind of moving on to more other types of models to see if in more physically based models we can start to incorporate these integrated effects of distributed soil hydraulic properties and hydrologic response. And so,
what time is it?
I guess just a couple of summary points I wanted to make is that, you know, this connectivity from the, you know, the soil scale to the catchment scale really moderates these catchment water fluxes. And I think that those moderations are enhanced in dry times, dry environments where we have these switches from dry to wet conditions. Soil storage capacity, at least in a lot of the sites we're working in, really regulate that connectivity through the distributions of soil depth and the retention capacities, and those, the impact of soil properties are felt throughout the catchment. And then this threw in at the end here when I realized we might have some time, is that if we want to start thinking about improved physically based catchment modeling, we need to think about ways to incorporate what might be these seemingly site-specific connectivity indices, because really when you're looking around at all the different watersheds and from these examples, each site seems to have kind of a different important connectivity mechanism. And well, we can't, you know, if we're modeling at larger and larger scales, we don't have the time or the computational power or energy to incorporate site-specific connectivity mechanisms. So there's a discussion question, perhaps, is how do we move forward with the knowledge, you know, to make progress with the knowledge of what's really going on in our small watersheds? And I'll end there.
Thanks. I think that was a great way to start off this session, and I'm really impressed that you managed to get right on time with the extra time. So that's great. We have, if you came in late, we had a missing talk, so we asked if Jim would expand and fill that slot as well, which he did brilliantly.
So,
yeah, that was coming next. But we do have some time for questions for Jim, or if you want to lead off with some general questions on the session, please.
I think it might be. I also think in this particular case it might be soil texture. This is really sandy soils, and I don't know if you need macropores. And they're there, and we see, you know, pipe flow at very wet times, but generally we're very sandy, very coarse grained, and we're hardly ever above, if this is, you know, I know field capacity is kind of a contentious term maybe, but I'm going to say it, and we're hardly ever above field capacity where we're getting enough drainage, I think, to use whatever macropores are there.
So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do, and we actually, in this particular site, we have a lot of anecdotal information about the higher elevations, but we haven't instrumented the elevation sites this level of detail. But you know, our field notebooks are full of those observations, like, hey, yeah, there's a pipe flowing right now. So the next round of proposals, moving up in elevation. But you're right, we do see very different processes going on. And I think you can see, you know, in the soil storage, even just looking at those differences, that there's different things going on. Not just hydrologically, but the vegetation, and its effect on the energy balance as well. I think it is. I think it is energy balance, and primarily through the effects of vegetation. Up here, we're up in the fully forested zone. Both the north-facing and south-facing aspects are fully forested, and as we get, which either mean we kind of moderate the impact of solar radiation, or you know, differences in evapotranspiration, and as we get to the lower elevations, it gets hotter and drier, and I think the vegetation changes. And these elevations, there's some shrubs and some trees with a lot of sagebrush. We get down here, and it's essentially grasses. And you know, not long after the snow melts over, you can look up on the hill slopes and see the green grasses on the north facing slopes, and there's the brown grasses in the south facing slopes. So I think it's related to those vegetation differences. It's all the Idaho batholith, which is it's a granitic uplift, 60 million years old, very similar. Now, the big geological differences is that basin asymmetry here, but the underlying bedrock is all granite, just fractured granite, which, you know, we like to assume is impermeable, right? It's not, you know. But we actually have mapped the fracture distribution throughout the watershed, and we really don't see a difference on the aspects of the fractures. But we actually have a student, this is Mike Poulos, working on this now. But so.
Good. Any other questions? I think you've earned a seat.
All right. Round of
applause.
Thanks.
Very nice.